Well, hello everyone. Welcome to another episode of Double Shelix. My name is Kayla.
And I'm Sally. And today is the second part on our two-part series about having children and being pregnant in graduate school or as an early career scientific professional. Last time we talked about everything pregnancy, and today we're going to talk about everything new parent, specifically new moms, specifically our two experiences. All the usual caveats apply. This is just the experience of two people. We will share a call at the end for our listeners to share their stories on our blog. But for now, let's dive in. So I think last episode we left off with a birth. Kayla, anything you want to share about the birth of your child / birthing children in general as a scientific worker?
Wow. Well, I will say, since you mentioned as a scientific worker, I don't know if you had this experience, but I was totally nerding out at like how all of this crazy biomechanics happens. Side story, but similar to what you said last time, which is that you had a very median pregnancy, I would say I also had a very median birth experience. If the doctor said it would happen a certain way, it happened that way, which I think is good. I mean, not saying that birth is easy at all, but it's definitely not a traumatic experience. How about you?
Yeah, in that way, very similar, not traumatic, good, normal. We're lucky, I think, in that way.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, with that in mind, like some of our responses are definitely colored by that experience. Yeah, how was maternity leave? So there's a couple of different aspects on how was maternity leave. Let's start with just the basics, which is recovery. How was that for you? Like, did you feel like it was long enough time for you to recover before returning to work?
Physically, my recovery was fine, and I was physically capable of going back to work after 9 weeks. I guess I will say that I feel lied to about how hard breastfeeding is.
Yes.
I went to the lactation consultant and she was like, these are normal problems. Like, there's nothing really wrong. Just keep trying. You're doing well. And I was like, this is a nightmare. I'm trying so hard and it's going so bad. And my baby doesn't have any food. But I was honestly like, it was pretty fine / normal experience. And it was like awful.
Yeah.
It was. And I know Kayla had an even worse experience.
It was terrible. I hated it.
And we still both did it because we're like that kind of person. Maybe we should have given up.
Yeah, it's terrible. Hopefully other people don't have this experience the same way that we did. But I do think it's like, I wish this is especially related to work. I feel like I got some training on how to do this, but the training was it didn't really cover how to do breastfeeding while you're working.
It was like cup the breast and then use your thumb and then put the baby here. But it wasn't like, how are you supposed to pump when you have to do a 4-hour tissue culture experiment?
Exactly. Or like, how is pumping going to work, or anything related to balancing work? Or like, what do you do if you have to fly? There are some physical aspects to this that I felt very unprepared for and like kind of alone in experiencing, even though obviously other people have experienced this. Just because we talked about it mostly with this assumption that you're going to be home with your baby forever doing this. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, and you flew to interview for your current postdoc, like when your baby was what, like 8 weeks old?
Yes. Yeah. So I was like taking the crash course in this, which I did see recently a very nice article about like how to deal with pumping and flying, which I'm going to add to the show notes. I wish that I had read that before doing that flight, but.
When you're on a 6-hour flight and your baby's 8 weeks old, you can't go 6 hours without taking milk out of your boobs or it's going to hurt.
Yeah. So that's the other thing I'll add to this, which I was not prepared for how much time it takes, especially at the beginning.
Like, but yeah, break it down. So like, let's say you're coming back to work after like a 10-week parental leave. Like, how much time are you spending pumping? How often?
I mean, when the baby was first born, I was spending maybe 10 hours a day And then after returning to work, it was much more manageable because your baby gets bigger, but it's still maybe like every 3 to 4 hours, which puts you, I mean, at least two pumping sessions a day. And of course, there's like huge variability in this, but like, I don't know. I don't, from everything that I have read, that it's very hard to like stretch this past maybe the 4 to 5 hour mark.
Until your baby's old enough that they can also eat some food. I think I sidetracked the conversation about maternity leave by saying breastfeeding sucks and I feel lied to. But another thing that I didn't anticipate about maternity leave is it's really lonely. And maybe this is coupled because I was taking my leave during the early days of the COVID pandemic. The real early days, not like in 20 years, we'll look back on 2021 and think that was early days. But anyway, because my baby was born around Valentine's Day 2020. And so my leave was just as everything was shutting down, et cetera. Right when I finally felt like I could take her out of the house on a regular basis to like maybe go to a park or to the store for something that isn't just like one grocery item, and like couldn't because the stores were closed. But the loneliness, man, it's like, what are you supposed to do all day? There's no one to talk to. Once your husband or partner goes back to work, in my case, we took two weeks together in the beginning, then I took my leave, and then he took the rest of his. Every day at like 3:30, I would like break down because I'd be like, there's still 4 more hours until my husband comes home, and what am I supposed to do? So that was, yeah. What about you?
Yeah, the loneliness was real. I was also not prepared for that. So on one hand, I was very excited to have a new baby. It was a lot of new experiences there, but also I was not prepared for how much the baby was going to sleep. And so during, like sometimes I would sleep also because you're exhausted all the time too. But a lot of the time is very lonely. I missed having adult conversations and intellectual conversations with people. I made an effort to each day shower, key, go outside, also key, and try to like read or do something that was not related to parenting. So like read a magazine or anything. And then also I tried to spend time talking to people. It definitely wasn't enough, but I remember we had a good time going on a couple of walks when you had a holiday here and there.
I also tried to shower every day and leave the house every day. And if you're a new parent listening to this and you're like, baby's really tiny, and you're like, I couldn't possibly do that. Is this I developed this rules for myself because I in the early first few weeks, like really early, like there was good days and bad days, and the good days all had that in common. Like even if she was totally crying like the whole time I showered and I could like hear her the whole time, still worth it. Sorry, she lived. It'll be fine. Still worth it to me to just, and sometimes like our morning walk was at 4:45 p.m. when it's like almost dark out,
Oh,
because
same.
that's how long it took before she had a clean diaper. We had both eaten. I had showered. She wasn't asleep. She had a clean outfit. Like I finished cooking. I pumped, like, et cetera.
Had prepared like the backup diaper and the backup milk and the
Listen.
backup whatever, so that when there's a catastrophe after you're 10 minutes out the door, you're ready. Yeah, I get it.
So that's my advice I tell to new parents is like, figure out what's the common denominator on the good days and like force that to happen on days as much as you can, you know, but also like have grace and flexibility with what happens and no one's experience is the same. I will share also a life hack, which is that Kayla shared with me, like when you have to feed the baby at night, you don't want to wake up too much.
No.
So I would scroll reading on my phone, but then I would just come back to bed like paralyzed with fear about the coronavirus for like 3 hours. And then she would be up again for her next feeding. To be fair, this was like March 2020, so
Yeah,
valid.
for everyone out there, Sally called it. I was a witness. She
Yeah,
was
I was
telling.
worrying about COVID in January. Between midnight, at least on the West Coast, between like midnight and like 5 a.m. there's no new news articles. There's no new tweets or Instagram posts. So you're like really scraping the bottom of the barrel for content to consume. So you can have two options. One is to read COVID news that's coming fresh out of Italy or China, which were the hotspots at the time. Don't recommend. Two is audiobooks. They're perfect because you don't have to like queue up the next one like a podcast, or like every podcast is about COVID. So that's kind of not what you're looking for. But I was also like in a kind of fragile emotional state. So like I couldn't listen to anything sad or scary at all. So I would just listen to a lot of audiobooks, like those celebrity memoirs written by comedians, like Amy Schumer's book or Tina Fey's book, etc. Audiobooks. Do you have any like hacks or things that took you a while to figure out what you had figured out sooner?
Yeah. Low lights. Don't try to pump at night. That was dumb.
Oh yeah. I did that. Real dumb.
Also, we kind of related to the recovery loneliness process. Guess what makes it worse? Sleep deprivation.
Listen, I read a statistic that was like, which is very sobering and we should all be aware of, if like there's a deep connection between getting 4 hours of uninterrupted sleep or more and incidence of postpartum anxiety and depression. And I read that. I was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Because on nights where like the feedings were too close together and I couldn't sleep for 4 hours in a row, it was so much harder to deal with every single thing. And even if, you know, once you pass the 4 hour mark, it's still trash, but it's like way easier. So we would have, that's why I had to pump during the day so that Steven could feed her a bottle at night. And so then I could like skip one of the feedings.
Yeah.
And like, did I wake up in a pool of my own breast milk the first few times I skipped a feeding at night? I certainly did. It was a real nasty.
Yeah, I feel you. I just was sweating all the time. I wasn't prepared for that. Yeah, so the sleep was tough. I learned that you have to sleep roughly 4 hours continuously to have normal tear production.
Oh, I remember you telling me about this. So tell me what it's like to cry but have no tears come out.
Yeah, it hurts. I just got up and I was like, my eyes just hurt and I found myself just like constantly blinking and I couldn't figure out what's going on. And then of course I read about it. And then, so yeah, well, that's definitely the problem. This is the day I didn't sleep last night.
Yeah. Another one, speaking of like homeostasis of water in your body, is that if you are breastfeeding, which like we said, it's trash. So if you don't breastfeed, more power to you, honestly. anyway, there's like this 84-ounce water bottle with a straw. This is the key. Get two. Keep one by your bed. Keep one by where you nurse. Okay. You don't have to like sit up from bed to drink it because it has a straw and it's 84 ounces. So you don't even have to refill more than once a day. Like I was downing like multiple of those per day because when you're breastfeeding, you need a lot of water. And the other thing, speaking of like intake and outtake of food, I guess we have on here, like, what would you do differently next time? Ask for help. Like only two, partly because it was like a pandemic and we weren't sure like what food was safe or whatever. Only two people brought us food.
Yeah, that's rough.
Like I told my mom, I was like, Mom, I feel like I'm wasting away.
And you wonder like, what can you do for other people? You can bring them food.
Yeah, listen. Kayla, any other things on leave before we move on? Any other experiences from your leave that you want to?
Yeah, there's two things that I want to talk about. One is, did you have any experience with postpartum depression or baby blues?
When you have a new baby, every time you go to the OBGYN or pediatrician checkup, they give you like a survey to fill out about, which is a screening for postpartum depression anxiety. And you can Google it and find it online. There's like 10 questions. And when I did it at my 3-week postpartum appointment with my OBGYN, my score was like 13, which is like the maybe region.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, she's like, well, everyone that I've checked this week, no one has been below a 13. Because it was like, it was like the first week of March, 2020.
Oh yeah.
So she's like, do you feel like you're stressed out about the pandemic or do you feel like it's because of the baby? And I was like, listen, it's the same thing. And she's like, okay, thanks. No, she was helpful. So I think like my experience with that was like very colored with COVID.
Yeah. I can't really say I experienced postpartum depression strongly. I think maybe a little bit of like normal baby blues, but
But it's hard to know what's normal, right?
It's
And I know
hard
people
to
that
know.
did have postpartum depression and they thought it was normal too until someone was like, girl,
not normal.
Not normal.
Okay, so the other thing I wanted to talk about is working on leave, because I feel like this is a question I have been asked several times. It's like, did you work on leave? Do I need to work on leave? Sally.
This is a uniquely academic question. If you are a salaried employee at a real company, every week that you work even 1 hour, they have to pay you. So like if you're on leave, you really can't do any work, or else the company, so like there's a more clear boundary when you work for a large company. Startups, academia, other perhaps more toxic industries, I'm looking at you, the law, I'm looking at you, consulting, et cetera, may be a different situation. But I was pretty clear that I wouldn't be doing much on leave. I told them to like text me if you need me, because I'm not going to be looking at my email that much. So they would text me like, where's the food for the muscle tank or whatever. Actually, no, I killed all the muscle before I left. We can end up now. They would text me if there was something urgent, or like text to say, I emailed you this, will you review? I think I like provided edits on one paper for which I was like a fifth author. That's about it.
So you did work some.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you had to?
Well, no, but if they send me the manuscript and there's things that should be better about the manuscript, I'm not going to not do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's just my personality. But like if I had been sent 10 manuscripts because I was the author on 10 manuscripts, JK, that's never going to happen for me. But then I wouldn't have done it. But it's like,
yeah,
it was a few hours. It was almost near the end of my leave. So
I see. Yeah.
What about you?
I did not feel like I had to. After a couple of weeks, I was starting to like the loneliness part also tied in with like feeling restless, I think.
It's like, let's just check Slack. Let's see what's going on.
Yeah,
humans.
Exactly. So I did start to engage a little bit, but it was pretty minor. I did also, in the vein of trying to do something intellectually interesting, I started like to format my thesis a little bit.
And but, you also cold emailed your current PI to ask for this job.
Oh, I did. I forgot about that, actually.
I remember you lamenting, being like, Sally, I've only emailed 3 people to ask for postdocs and it's been like a month. And I was like, honestly, cold emailing people is so hard.
Yeah.
That even if you were working full time, I probably couldn't have done more than 3 in a month, because it's like you write the email, you reread the email, you reformat your CV, you reread it again, you think about sending it, so.
If there was like, sometimes I hate that there's no callback button for your email after a few seconds, but if there was, it would be just a continual loop of not sending emails. Anyway, yeah, I did do that. And I feel like, so I most, like on a day that I would do something, at most it was like 1 or 2 hours a day. And it was usually in the afternoon when I was like in my best spirits and the baby was asleep. Yeah. So I feel like my take home message from this is like, you should feel emotional permission not to work. And you should also feel emotional permission to work if that's what's going to get you through a weird day. But like don't have expectations. Zero expectations.
Other people who are not the person having the baby or their partner should have zero expectations about work that the person on leave is doing. Furthermore, they should not refer to it as a vacation. It's way easier, at least in my experience, to pull a 14-hour lab day or a 16-hour lab day. And
yeah,
than it is to take care of a baby.
Yeah.
It's not a vacation. And I think what I hear a lot actually is people referring to the dad's parental leave as a vacation.
Yeah.
And I think that having a double standard where like the dad's like, oh, have like, where they're like, have fun on your vacation. It's like, you know, if caring for children wasn't a job, you could find someone to do it for free. You cannot find someone to watch your baby for free. When I was in graduate school at Berkeley, I paid $2,300 a month for someone to watch my baby from the hours of 8 a.m. until 5:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. You can work out the per hour, And think about who was paid more, me on a graduate stipend from the National Science Foundation or the daycare.
Yeah.
Which is great. We should pay daycare workers. But the point is, if watching a baby was easy, people would do it for free and they don't. So
yeah. Yeah. Definitely not a vacation. All right. So coming back to work, let's just start with childcare. I think that's key. So Sally, how was your experience finding a childcare, affording a childcare, et cetera?
Yeah. Finding childcare, it was a nightmare. There were only two daycares within distance where I could, within walking distance of campus, that I could possibly send my child. And one was through the university owned system. And the other was this place where Kayla's son also went.
Mm-hmm.
And the university-owned system, you know, oh, they provide financial need. But since I have a partner that has a real job, we did not meet the financial need. And frankly, even two graduate students would make, quote unquote, enough money to not meet the financial need. Like financial need is like really a single parent undergrad making no money. They would qualify, maybe. But there were not any spots available. And really the only reason that I got a spot at the other daycare was it was in mid-March before things had shut down. They emailed me. They said, there's a spot available. The next day, the daycare closed for COVID for a few months. Oh, and I think the reason that I got a spot is that some other parent took their kid out because of COVID fears. A spot opened up and I was able to get it for my child. And it's really expensive and it's really stressful. And why did I need a place within walking distance of daycare or of my lab? And it's because, like, I don't have a second car because parking on campus is ridiculously expensive. I can't afford it. And so I would need to take public transit. But as you know, public transit, especially on the bus, is really unreliable. So if I were to reliably have to be at a place at 5:30:00 every single day, even if it's only a 20-minute bus ride, I would have to basically leave at 4:30 every day. So to me, like, I wouldn't be able to pick my child up reliably. And my husband at the time worked across the river in San, or across the bay in San Francisco, where traffic is even more unreliable. So he wouldn't be able to pick her up unless he left at like 3:15 to guarantee that he's there by 5:30. So it was basically a nightmare. We were really lucky.
And for the record, usually places, they charge you a lot if you're late. So being late is not an option. And when we're mostly focused on like a center-based daycare, there's obviously other options, but they often don't take the baby until the baby's 6 months old. You, at least sometimes places will take like younger babies. So you're already sort of like competing for this spot, which it is quite competitive to find any spots. And then you're trying to figure out like what you're going to do until the baby's old enough, because maternity leave is shorter than the time that they start taking your kid. And then it's really expensive. I have twice now, and we've had a lot of different child cares in the last short time that we've had a child, just because of the move and the pandemic and stuff. But at least two of the options were more expensive per month than rent. So I think that transitions into affording childcare as a grad student. I remember thinking, okay, like when we were like sort of planning, like having a kid's expensive, but really what makes it expensive is the childcare. Like, yes, there's other costs, like materials costs, but compared to the childcare, and I mean, we were living in an expensive place, but this is true across the country. Like, and I think this is a unique question for affording childcare as a grad student, because your salary is pretty low. So I don't know if you have anything you want to add to that. I mostly wanted to identify how expensive this is, because I often see like how like universities are offering grants, which is great, but like they're still really quite small compared to the
The child care grant is like $2,000. So that's like 3 weeks of daycare.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think, okay, we've been beating around the bush, but the fact is universities, you're already underpaying people. The entire academic system is set up in terms of the work hours, in terms of the compensation. It's set up for a man who has a stay-at-home wife. And if I didn't have a partner that worked in industry, like I wouldn't have been able to afford childcare, and I would have chosen to not have a child. societally in the United States, we view children as the responsibility of the individual parent or parents, not as the responsibility of the whole society, which is why in the United States, we don't have parental leave, which is why in the United States, we don't have free childcare. You know, we do have free childcare, but it doesn't start till your kid is five and it's called school. You know, why are we not taking care of all of the children of our society? And the answer is because the patriarchal society thinks that the mom can just stay home. Like, that's how this was designed. There's politicians serving in office in this country today who will openly admit that they think our society would be better off if moms stayed home. So anyway, universities need to pay everyone more, especially if they're trying to like open the doors for people from different backgrounds to be scientists. Like, they all say that, but what are they doing to make that easier for people of different backgrounds, including parents? You know, it doesn't take that much money to provide 10 weeks of parental leave to all of your graduate students. And what universities are doing that? I don't know. It's just like such a low cost for such a high benefit, as your students are happier, their retention is high. We know that when women are given longer parental leaves, they're more likely to stay on their chosen career paths in the future. I feel like our audience knows this, feels like agrees with me.
So I think this brings us to another point, which is the motherhood penalty.
Oh, tell us more.
So I think you mentioned this when we were sort of discussing this outline, which is that if you aren't a mom, you may not realize how much that the moms or potential moms are worrying about this, which I think is true. And it's like touches on your point of like making family decisions based on what the policies are in your institution. Did you feel like you experienced the motherhood penalty personally? I mean, ultimately, I feel like we won't know until we have reached an outcome, like maybe 20 or 30 years down the road, right? But like, also, did you feel like you were experiencing anything early on?
Here's what I'll say. I share very openly on this podcast. You could listen to every episode and learn a lot about my life and how I think. And I think that's good. And I think sharing our experiences have ultimately helped a lot more people than any downside potential to Kayla or me. Like, it's a wash, right? But you will note that neither Kayla nor I revealed the existence of our beloved children who mean the world to us until we were already secure in our new post-PhD positions. I did not reveal my status as a mom to any of the companies I was working for until I had an offer in writing. And that was intentional and strategic, and I would do it again in a heartbeat, because there is bias against moms, because moms might leave the workforce. Moms might have to leave early, even at companies that are like, we're flexible about family.
I heard somebody on a hiring committee say, well, that candidate has kids. I looked up on Facebook. And they're not going to want to move here. So I don't want to waste an offer on them.
That's assumptions. This is what we're talking about all the time. If you interact with parents, you should never, ever make an assumption.
I think the not assuming what somebody wants based on their parental status is really key. And this applies to like, do you want to travel? I think we talked about this a little bit last time. Like, what do you want to do for your career? How involved do you want to be in a project? It's better just to ask the questions than to make a guess. Yeah. So I guess this just all underscores the importance of parental leave, supporting new parents in staying in science, being aware of those biases against parents and trying to not make assumptions about their next steps in their career path. And either way, like maybe they do want to leave and that's fine, but maybe they don't. And so don't try to guess.
So Kayla, as we've talked about, like my new baby was during COVID, but your new baby was during regular times. So can you talk about how, like after you returned from leave and you're back at work, like how was your day-to-day different? What things were unexpected besides pumping, which we already got into? Like what changed and what stayed the same in terms of your day-to-day?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'll say that I definitely missed my baby. I experienced tremendous mom guilt because I wasn't there and the baby is still so small. And this like little human is depending so much on me. And I think we have some nearly impossible standards for ourselves as parents and as scientists. So that was definitely difficult. I also felt like, okay, what happened while I was gone? Which, like, for better or worse, leave is short enough that not much is the answer. But I still think, like, you come in with this new identity as a parent. And so it takes a little bit of adjustment to combine that identity with who you are in your professional career. At least for me, it did. It took a little bit to just readjust mentally. And then on a practical scale, I had to learn how to schedule everything. Because I couldn't just show up and like get distracted by some other experiment for the day and then be like, oh, well, I'll just stay for an extra 3 hours. No big deal. Like, it's like, nope. Okay. I need to stay focused. I need to prioritize. What are the things I absolutely have to get done while I'm here? And like, if I have to, I can go home and like take care of things and then answer some emails late at night. But like, what do I have to do before 5 o'clock? Yeah. So scheduling everything, especially too, when you're taking pumping breaks, that's challenging. Mm-hmm. If you're like running a super long experiment, it's like, okay, so I got to plan not only around the start and end point of my day, but also like these random breaks. And I would add some encouragement that it is doable, but it does just take a lot of planning, lot of planning.
And flexibility and lack of assumptions on the part of your colleagues and coworkers. I think that's a key theme in this episode, as well as in the previous episode.
On the flip side is that I got a lot more efficient. So
which is saying something, because you were like way efficient than all the rest of us, like for this whole time.
I felt more emotional permission to not do things that weren't important or to excuse myself if something was taking up too much time. So like if I was in a maybe interesting conversation, but also I knew that I still had 3 hours of experiments to do before I left, I'd be like, this has been great, but I gotta go because I'm on a deadline.
Yeah, I will say for me, I wasn't doing lab work in the early time because I was writing my thesis during the pandemic with the baby while looking for a job.
Yeah.
But I will say that one thing that was unexpected in my day-to-day is that like if your kid goes to daycare, they're going to get sick all the time.
Yes.
And if your kid is sick, they can't go to daycare.
Yes.
So if you have a coworker, your kid could be sick like an impossible amount of time. So if you have a coworker who's like, I can't come in, my kid is sick, they are not lying to you. They are miserable and their kid is sick. And if you have multiple kids and then like one is sick and then gets the next one sick, then like none of them can go to, especially in the COVID era, rightfully so, like none of them can go to school if one of them is sick.
I think I read that the average number of colds slash illnesses in an infant is 11 times.
Yeah, like,
a year. Like that's once a month.
Between like May and October, when we first moved here to Southern California for my new job, my daughter had two colds. She had pneumonia. She had roseola. She had a stomach virus. She had like three other diagnosed illnesses that I don't even remember. And it was like every time that we'd get a diagnosis where it's like, oh, thank God she has roseola, something that we can't catch.
And that's not COVID.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. But it's like when she had a stomach flu, then of course we all get the stomach flu. And then it's
Yes. And the level of misery when you're sick and you're taking care of a sick child, it's just, that's one of my like minor parental nightmares.
And like Caleb was the one that told me, like, when your kid is sick, they regress to like the newborn sleep schedule. So waking up every 90 minutes.
I know of a person whose kid got very sick. I mean, the kid was fine, but the kid was sick. This was before COVID. So before like we all sort of bristled at somebody roughing their nose, right? But it was an illness that was like contagious enough that the person just started working at night, like completely when nobody else was there. so they could still get some stuff done, but that they wouldn't infect their coworkers. And I just, that's,
See, like, no.
I don't know. It's just, it's a very difficult situation to be in for sure.
Yeah.
And I think
But
it's especially tricky when you're doing bench work, as opposed to other things that, like, yes, I can do a lot of my work from home, but like I can't do these month-long experiments at home. Anyway, was not prepared for that. Is there any other like unique challenges about returning to work that you feel like we haven't talked about?
I think we covered the big ones.
Yeah. With all, so we, this, I mean, we've sort of, it's gotten real on this episode, Sally.
That's the best kind.
I think, is there anything that we want to leave on a more positive note?
Yes, the more positive note is that change is possible. Leave, flexibility, near to the university, affordable childcare for graduate students and other workers. These are all things that are possible. And if you have tenure, you need to be raising the alarm on this. Pick your battles, but this is one you should all pick.
Yeah, I
I know
agree.
tenured faculty listen to this, and so I won't call them out by name, but you know who you are.
Yeah, you know, this sort of resonates with one of our past episodes, which we were talking about why women leave science. And of course, there is a myriad of reasons. And I am not saying that this is the only reason, but this is certainly one of the reasons and one of the big reasons.
And they don't leave science because they have children. This is the misconception. The misconception is that women have children and then they leave science. The reality backed up in the peer-reviewed literature is that women leave science because they are not afforded flexibility. This change is possible, but you can't just sit and wait for it to come to you. Like, what are you doing if you have power to make it happen?
Yeah. Putting it all together, was it worth it, Sally?
Yes.
Yes.
If I was less worried about what other people thought of me, I would have had the kid baby sooner. What about you?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Absolutely. I stressed about it more than was necessary by a lot. I suspect that this episode will be listened to by people who are either just genuinely curious or that they want to have a baby and they're looking to hear some people's experiences who've been through it. I stressed about it too much, and I want other people to hear that that maybe
Yeah, and
and I should have had what I wish I would have had was the self-confidence to just be like, I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna not make it a big deal, and I'm gonna keep going, and it's gonna be fine. But also, like, I had a good support system, both professionally and personally. So would I have the same answer if it had been different? I don't know, but
yeah. Many grad students having children are considering, like, they're away from their main support system. Like, they're often move away from their immediate family. You know, they don't have all that around. And some of them do, which is great, but understanding that they need support and that can be money, that should be money, that should be leave, and it can be other things too. I think that's really important. We're lucky because so many people like pursuing the academic or medical track are really like, you know, these cutthroat careers in any sector, like they often put off having kids because they are worried about their career advancement. I think, you know, we're a success story in this, and my heart goes out to everyone who is afraid and or not having the family planning outcomes that they want. It's really tough.
I am optimistic that there can be more success stories. So,
Yes.
yeah.
Yes. And this is the kind of thing like when I wanted to have a baby, but like when I was considering it or whatever, like I didn't have anyone I could ask about these experiences. Like I could ask you, Kayla, but your baby's only 5 months older than mine. So there wasn't like that much more than you that you knew about than me,
Right,
you know? So I
exactly.
wish I could have like listened to this when I was in second year and like made a more informed plan and like,
Yes,
you know,
same,
felt more
totally the
confident.
same. Totally the same. Yeah. I definitely felt like, well, we're just gonna see how this goes. I think when I was like, searching the internet for personal stories about this, I could find like two. And when I like try different key terms, I'd pull up the same two every time. So Shout out to those two stories. Thanks for getting me through, but also would, you know, love to see more success stories like that. Which I think on that note, if anybody listening has stories on this line of topics that they would love to share, we are seeking blog posts. So please email us at doubleshelikespodcast@gmail.com. I finally got it right. Right? That's it,
yeah.
Right? Okay. I don't know why I always struggle with that. Yeah, so definitely reach out to us if you have something you want to share. It can be anonymous to whatever degree you prefer. Also, all the usual things like our podcast.
Yeah.
Subscribe.
There's probably someone in your life that could listen, that could benefit from this episode. So like, tell it to them.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything else?
Yeah. No, thank you for listening. If you like this episode, let us know and we can make more content like this. Again, this is only two people's opinion and perspective, but we hope that it helps because we wish that we had had it. And that's why we started this podcast in the first place. And I think that especially holds true in this episode.
Yeah.
So until next time.